So this has been an ongoing series on transforming judgmental mind and holding judgmental mind as just judging, period, whether it's of oneself or another. It's the same part of us. And it's pretty much a law. If you're hard on yourself, you're hard on others. If you're hard on others, you're hard on yourself. So there's really not a distinction. And tonight I'm focusing on loving kindness as the antidote, as the opposite of judging minds. And the Buddha spoke very clearly about loving kindness being the antidote, not just to aversion, judging minds, but also to fear. So if fear is one of your particular specialties and skills, like many of us, then the loving kindness practice is a really good practice. So metta, or loving kindness, is just a state of basic friendliness. Friendliness towards others, towards yourself. Friendliness towards whatever is arising in your mind stream. Basic friendliness. And the Buddhist view is that we love this state of basic friendliness. We really like being friendly. It's not the only thing we like, but it's one of the very, very deep-seated urges within us. We love connecting and we long to belong. We love this feeling of being friendly and connected with ourselves and others. So here's some verses from Hafiz, who is an Iranian mystic poet of the 14th century. He writes, "Admit something. Everyone you see, you say to them, 'Love me.' Of course you do not do this out loud, otherwise someone would call the cops. Still, though, think about this great pull in us to connect. Why not become the one who lives with a full moon in each eye that is always saying, with that sweet moon language, what every other eye in this world is dying to hear?" So the practice of loving kindness is really the practice of that sweet moon language that we're all dying to hear and be. This state of real, genuine friendliness. But we limit ourselves with our thoughts. We limit who we deem capable of our love and who is not worthy of our love. And we especially limit our ability to experience this kind of friendliness with our judging mind. As the saying goes, if you want to rescue yourself from basic well-being and ease, start judging. So the focus tonight is on metta for oneself, on love for oneself. And this is very noble, very worthy, said the Buddha. It's not selfish. The Buddha said you can search throughout the entire universe for someone who is more deserving of your love and affection than you are yourself. And that person is not to be found anywhere. You yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection. Self-love is not selfish. It doesn't obliterate other people. Obliterating others and losing focus or sight of others is self-centeredness. Self-love is not that. Self-love is just simply holding yourself in basic friendliness, feeling friendly towards yourself, feeling your good heart. And if you have any kind of upbringing that makes you feel squeamish about this, then put in front of cultivating self-love, put in front of it the motivation to be of benefit to others. The more we're abiding in self-love and basic friendliness towards ourselves, the more available we are to the world. And so our self-love is a kind of gift. So we can make our motivation to be of benefit to others through loving ourselves. Basically, the world needs our self-love. We're just that much more available to help when we're really abiding in genuine, positive self-regard. So it wasn't just the Buddha who talked about this. Lao Tzu in the Tao Te Ching wrote, "I have just three things to teach: simplicity, patience, compassion. These three are your greatest treasures. Simple in action and in thoughts, you return to the source of being. Patient with both friends and enemies, you accord with the way things are. Compassionate toward yourself, you reconcile all beings in the world." It's a very profound statement. Compassionate towards yourself, you reconcile all beings. When you disarm in your own heart, you are disarmed outwardly. You are living in ease and peace with the world when you're at ease and peace in your own heart. And in our loving kindness practice, it's just built on this idea that the object of our affection and our friendliness doesn't matter. Whether it's directed inwardly or outwardly, we are exercising the heart muscle of friendliness when we cultivate friendliness in our meditation practice, in our metta practice. And in the classical Buddhist metta practice, kindness towards yourself is the first category of beings. There's six categories. And it goes from easiest to most difficult. So the self is considered to be the easiest, and then a benefactor is the next category, and then a dear friend, and then a neutral person, a difficult person, and all beings. So we start with what's easy. We just want to kind of exercise our friendliness muscle. Doesn't really matter who it's directed towards. For many of us, starting with ourselves is not the easiest person. 2,500 years ago, life was a lot different, apparently. 'Cause self might be towards the difficult end of beings for many of us. But we're going to experiment and see what happens if we do that tonight, if we actually do some loving kindness practice directed towards ourselves. So there's a lot to be said about why for us self-love can be so hard. I've talked about in general just the human negativity bias in the brain, neuroscience finding such things as the brain recognizes a negative expression much more quickly than a happy expression. So if people are shown photos of a fearful expression and a happy expression, I don't know how they do this, but they can map that much more quickly the brain registers the fear expression. We have a negativity bias in our brain, and that's just one example of all the different findings. So the thought is that somehow that the people who are scanning for what's wrong back in our evolutionary history, what's wrong could be life-threatening. And so people who scanned for that and more quickly registered that had a better chance of surviving, whereas someone who's just sort of swimming around in a little bliss cloud becomes lion food or whatever. So there's a negativity bias in the brain, And it's not personal. It's human. It's nobody's fault. We just are built this way. Now, it doesn't mean we have to be this way, but for most of us, it's pretty strong. To kind of deepen this theme, let me just guide you briefly. We'll just do kind of a short little one-minute meditation exercise. So if you would, just start by feeling your breath. In-breath. Notice if there's a gap or a pause. And out-breath. And then now open your field of awareness to include the full body. Notice whatever sensations are most obvious in the body right now. Now opening your attention to sound. How many different sounds can you notice? And now being aware of any images in the mind. You may be assigning image to sound or to sensation, or just having a memory. Now being aware of, are there any thoughts in the mind? And that's it. Okay. So when we move from noticing the breath to noticing the body, raise your hand if you notice a sensation that you didn't know had been there. And then when we open to sound, raise your hand if you notice sound that you hadn't previously noticed. And then when we move to image, raise your hand if you notice any images that you hadn't previously noticed, just a few. And then thoughts. So the basic idea is this, is that reality, now this is just speaking from one perspective, but from one perspective, reality is whatever we choose to pay attention to. So I was on a run yesterday, and I was noticing my body, my shoulders, and my chest were very relaxed, very easy, the breath going in and out. But my thighs were very heavy. Depending on where I placed my attention, it was a very heavy run, or it was just a light, open run. All depending on where my attention was. So, and when you meditate and you start to notice, there's a lot going on. There's breath, there's sensation, there's sound, there's image, there's thought. If your eyes are open, there's sight. And whatever we focus on is basically, in that moment, what's real to us. So a lot of you, especially when we open to sound, notice a lot of sound that you hadn't noticed before. If you're not aware of it, it's literally not there for you. So basically, we choose reality by what we choose to pay attention to. On a bad day, you might go into the park and only notice the dog crap. On a good day, you might go into the park and notice nothing but the blooming tulips and roses or whatever. But on each day, we think this is the true nature of parks. P- parks are just full of crap, or they're just nothing but ruby red tulips. And all we're doing is selecting our attention. And what we pay attention to is usually determined by how we feel on the inside already. And so we literally don't see the world as it is. We see the world as we are, often, unless we become conscious. But when we're just on autopilot, this is what we do. And then whatever we do a lot becomes habit. And so if we have a negativity bias, and that negativity bias that is sort of part of being human gets set by difficult patterns, say in childhood, where you learn to be really hard on yourself, then you just are really hard on yourself. And you're choosing reality, but you don't even know it. It's not just that parks are full of dog poo. It's that there's something wrong with you yourself. And we're basically, all we're doing is cherry-picking reality. We are taking some very tiny part of reality, I'm bad or something's wrong with me or whatever, and we just make it who we are. And it's just a thought. We might have thought it 10,000 times. All that means is it's a deep habit. It doesn't mean it's true. It's just a thought. And this is the really good news about all of our negative self-judgments. They're only true if we're thinking them. The minute we're thinking about what we ate for lunch today, we're no longer bad. Or the minute we're solving a work problem, we're no longer bad. And then we can come back to the thought, and then we think, I'm so bad, I'm so bad, I'm so bad. It's just a thought. If we don't realize it's just a thought, then we are defined by it. If we wake up and realize, oh yeah, I'm bad only when the thought's there. And when some other thought comes along, I'm no longer bad. We start to really lighten up. We realize we're just cherry-picking reality with our self-critical thoughts. Does that make sense? I hope. Mm-hmm. So this is very good news. Meditation really, we don't dispute our negative thoughts on the meditation cushion. We dethrone them by realizing they're just the mind movie of the moment. It's a home movie. It's a painful one. But thank God it's just a movie. It's just a thought. And the only power our thoughts have is the power we give them by being unconscious of them. If we're unconscious of them, they run us. They define us. If we wake up to them, we realize, there I go again. Having that very painful, very familiar thought. But thank God it's just a thought. As a psychologist, of course, I work with this a lot. And I've struggled with it a ton myself in my own life. And we know in the psychological world that negative beliefs can get cemented in very early, either through what we call developmental trauma, which means you just not getting your basic needs met, being loved for who you are. And then there's also event trauma, where really terrible things happen to people, whether it's abuse or accidents, natural disasters, really traumatic things happen. But in both cases, we cement in very deeply very negative thoughts about ourselves. On the developmental trauma side, basically, if for whatever reason, though our parents might have very good intentions and clearly loved us, if we weren't being met where we needed to be met, we don't take it in very well. And when we're not being met as we need to be met as children, we can't blame our parents. If you think about you know, a three-year-old being this tall and a parent being two or three times as tall, our parents are giants. And they're not just physical giants, they're giants in every possible way. We are psychologically not capable when we're very young of thinking our parents are wrong. We have to think it's us when our needs are not getting met. We have to deny our needs and judge our needs and believe that they're wrong. It's the only thing that makes sense to us. And making sense of the world is more important than loving ourselves when we're young. So we conclude something's wrong with us. And this gets set very early. And so the habit can be very strong. A friend of mine recently told me just a really painful story about her childhood. Her grandmother was a nun, a Catholic nun, and her mom wasn't deeply enmeshed with the church, but was still a pretty big part of it. And she explains it to me that you really just couldn't have a focus on yourself at all. In her family, to focus on the self. So this is not to globalize or generalize in any way about the Catholic Church, but she's naming her experience. For her, this felt like a Catholic experience, that to focus on yourself was very dangerous, because it was to basically turn your back on God. And her sister, I don't know how old she was, but young, just one day was dancing around and just loving her very pretty hair, and was just sort of dancing with the joy of her beautiful hair. Her mother cut her hair because of it, just cut her hair off. Yeah. It's visceral, right? Just the pain of that. I mean, these were good intentions. The person, you know, didn't want her daughter to be self-centered, as if somehow expressing joy about yourself was a self-centered thing. Yeah, there's a lot of pained looks. This was, you know, 40, 50 years ago. I don't think this would happen in Boulder now. But I think this stands in many ways for many of us, lessons we learned very early, that it wasn't okay to really love yourself, because that could be seen as vain or conceited. And self-love is none of those things. It's just friendliness. It's not saying I'm better than anyone. It's just saying I love myself. I'm pretty good. I like myself as I am. Absolutely healthy. So the other thing you may notice about yourself, if you have beliefs like this that got set very early, is that in a part of you, and in our therapy world, psychology world, we call these parts encapsulated. They're basically incapable of taking in new data. When we have this belief that there's something really wrong with us, we can have all kinds of data to the contrary. But some part of us is, the mind is made up and it's sealed over and it's encapsulated. Data doesn't matter. We can just have such a deep-seated belief that somehow we're deficient. So and then lastly, we can actually be very attached to these negative self-beliefs, even if it makes us miserable. And we're attached because it's familiar. And we can be in a kind of comfortable misery. And it can be very hard to break out of. So I'll read a poem that really speaks to this. It's called His Music by Stephen Dunn. His Music. It wasn't that he liked being miserable. He simply had grown used to wearing a certain face, become comfortable with his assortment of shrugs and sighs. His friends said, "How are you?" and prepared their sympathy cards. Miserable was his style, his insurance against life's frightening, temporary joys. And when the truly awful happened, some rejection or loss, how ready he was for its aftermath, how appropriate his posture, his words. Yet when she said she loved him, something silently wild and molecular began its revolution. He would have smiled if the news from the distant provinces of his body had reached him in time. He frowned and did not allow the short sigh which would have meant pleasure, but now alone was just old breath escaping the long ah, that music which soothed him and was his song. So we can have really deep-seated self-judgment. We can be attached to it because it's familiar, even if it is unhappy. And the really good news is it's not our fault. We have a human brain, so it has a negativity bias. And this is not to blame everything on mom or dad, but this is to get that we weren't born with a sense of basic badness. Babies don't come out that way. We learn it, typically. And there's lots of argument. Is there a genetic template that's set? Of course, there's some genetics involved. Yet, a lot is learned. And therefore, it's not really our fault. It's learned. And we can actually change our way out of it, even when the habits are really deep set. And that's what loving kindness practice is about. It's about orienting to the good in us and the good in others and feeling some kind of basic friendliness because of it. So our mindfulness practice helps us a lot with this. When we actually can watch our minds and watch the way our unworthy thoughts come about, we start to take it a lot less personally. And I was on a retreat and struggling a lot with just basic badness, just a lot of shame, a lot of embarrassment, a lot of unworthiness. And one of my teachers said to me, we were talking, and I was really suffering. She was very compassionate. And at one point, I had said something, and there was this whoosh of a car going by. And she could, you know, sense my practice. And she said, you know, Peter, someday you're going to realize this unworthiness is just as impersonal as the sound of that passing car. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm not sure what I said, but my thought was right, whatever. And it really actually became true. I can just give you one example from a different retreat, but I was at Spirit Rock, and there was this funny, like, plucky kind of click coming from the wall. I learned later it was a thermostat, but anyway. So my mind would hear this pluck. So this one time, there's pluck, and the next mind moment, the next thought was, plucking bass. And so then I heard the bass line in a jazz tune, in a John Coltrane tune, called Africa. And then because I was on retreat, my mind was very quiet. I was in this sort of like full-blown glory of a Coltrane jazz tune, just loving it. And then the next mind moment was infant bliss. I was in a state of original bliss, like an infant child. And that made me think of my infant son, godson, Luca, who I remembered in the next moment that one time when I was babysitting him, he loved to be in his car seat, and he was about 9 months or a year. And in his car seat, I was in the living room with him, and I was carrying him in his car seat, and I was going to put him down because I wanted to run to the kitchen and grab a chocolate chip cookie. So I put him down on a laundry basket on the floor and stepped away, and the whole thing toppled. And he bumped his head and was bawling, and he was okay after a while. But so this is my meditation. So pluck on the wall, right? We all know this, right? And then bass, and then Coltrane, and then Bliss, and then Infant, My Godson, and then toppling in the thing, and oh, God, what a terrible person I am. I'm so greedy, right? And I'm sitting there, greedy, greedy, God, bad, bad. It's like, where did that come from? A pluck on the wall. That's it. Just when you watch your mind, you see it. It actually is very impersonal. Our mind bounces around and cascades along, and we can watch all of our thoughts, and then and they're not us, and they're not us. But then the one I'm bad. Oh, right. Well, that one is me, unlike all my other thoughts. And whammo, you grab on, and you're sitting there. I'm so bad. I'm so bad. I'm so bad. And all it is a mind burp of the moment that you latched onto and believed to be true. All the other ones flowed by, but when that one comes, boom, you grab. So it's our mindfulness practice solves the riddle of judging yourself for being so judgmental. What is wrong with me? I am so hard on myself. Have you ever had that thought? God, if only I could stop judging myself. What is my problem? So mindfulness solves that. And that's aversion to aversion, which is just aversion. Aversion to aversion is aversion. So we don't get out of judging ourselves by judging ourselves. We only get out of it by stopping and noticing what our experience is like. And we break that cycle when we simply notice what it's like to be in this state of shame or judgment. So that's kind of a lot, I guess. And also how mindfulness can help. And then the second part of class will be around our loving kindness practice and self-love itself. And so let me just stop here and just open it up to see if there's questions or comments or... If you don't mind speaking up.
Sure. I was listening to a CD the other day of Eckhart Tolle, and he was talking about because there is no, ultimately, no solid self, he was saying something about that ultimately we don't even need to focus on loving ourselves because that's kind of a false sense of permanence.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so how does that play into what you're talking about?
In an ultimate sense, is exactly true. And yet, in an emotional sense, we already have a sense of basic badness, you know. So it's actually very skillful as a balance to really cultivate love for myself. We can say small s self, but it's an emotional state. So that's one answer. A more precise way of reconciling what he said is, since there is no self and we can't love a self technically, though emotionally we very much can and our practice will be about that, but technically what we need to love is what is. What we need to love is our experience. When we are not loving ourselves, what we're really not loving is the experience of the moment. So we're going to work with that tonight. We're going to do two practices. We're going to do this more general metta practice of self-love, but we're also going to do a practice of learning to be friendly towards our experience itself. Because when we are aware of ourselves, what we experience is not a self, but just a flux of experiences. So that's what we need to be friendly towards.
I enjoyed a lot of what you were saying. I probably have a lot of questions, but I think the one that's just up on the forefront is, for me, I tend to be very kinesthetic and a feeler. Mm. So I don't I mean, my mind definitely can race and have, like, if I'm in a lot of fear, I can go into more of my thoughts, then I don't feel as much. So, I guess for me, or I don't know what exactly my question is, but when I'm feeling like a deep-seated something negative about myself, usually it comes up in the form of a feeling and I don't know what the words are. So for me to even get in touch with what even the thought may be, I have to keep dropping more deeply into the feeling. And then that somehow brings light to, it's almost like I have to go down into the dark or whatever it is for me and just to fully have it and feel it for like what the actual thought is that's connected to it. And then it's like, oh, poof, it kind of goes. My process.
Great.
And I don't know if that's what that is, but that's just how I seem to experience.
Our practice is one of awareness. We are aware of our experience as it is. There is no correct way to be. There's no way. Some of us are kinesthetic. Some of us are emotive. Some of us are, you know, very rational. Some of us are very intuitive. We're all different. And there's no such thing as a way we're supposed to be. That's not mindfulness. Mindfulness is noticing how it is. And you're very clear for you. It starts kinesthetically, and it starts as a sensation and feeling in the body. And what you may also be on the lookout for as you do that is image. Because sometimes when there's not a lot of verbal thoughts, there can be visual thoughts in addition to the kinesthetic sensations. So sometimes it coalesces into image more than verbal thought.
It does. I mean, it can turn into that also. Yeah. I mean, depending on what it is.
Right. But it sounds like you really know how to work with your system.
I'd like to think come into that. Okay. Yes.
I appreciated the distinction you made between thought and beliefs. That's something that I agree with, basically seeing thought as phenomena that occur when attention is directed through a belief. So it's sort of like a hierarchy of sort of cognitive structure there, or the cognitive commitment that you've made that attention was not always directed through, but at times is. And I've seen, just so far in sort of from the Buddhist perspective, that distinction not being made, but very interestingly, I've seen that distinction being made in cognitive therapy type of discussion. And so far also, from the perspective of meditation practice, it seems a lot is focused on basically changing the relationship to thought, more so seeing it as impersonal, generic activity that you need not, you know, the content of which you need not get analytical about or suck into. But it seems that there's also potentially a mode of, if you could basically become aware of and undercut the belief itself, the belief that precipitates that thought over time.
I'm not sure I know of a distinction between thought and belief. So can you clarify for you what that means?
Well, the belief being something that's a construct that is there even when you're not thinking about it.
When it's just unconscious.
Like you were saying, something that you internalize, say like a negative belief about yourself.
So right.
Sort of is part of your inventory that's triggered under certain conditions.
I would actually say that we can still have thoughts as beliefs. They still express as thoughts, but that we just are unconscious of them. A belief, in my view, would still be a thought. It's whether we're conscious of it or not. So that's the distinction I would make.
I guess that's the thing I've been sort of chewing on recently, thinking in terms of working at that level, working with belief, working with thought. It seems like a more fundamental layer that you could sort of, rather than parsing through a thought at a time, basically undercut sort of that level of activity.
Yes, I mean, you could get to a core assumption that's under the thoughts. Is that kind of what you mean? That the thoughts are sort of organized along a certain pattern because of a certain belief under those thoughts.
It proliferates.
Yes, yes. But I would still say those are thoughts, in that we can be aware. So analytically, we could notice that our thoughts have an organizational pattern, and that pattern must have a belief under it, but that belief will still manifest in the now as a thought. So in all cases, we can just be aware of our thinking. In our mindfulness practice, we don't analyze, deconstruct, try to get at the root thought under all the thoughts. We just simply are with what is. So I'm not sure I'm getting to what you're asking, but I just need to clarify that as part of the question.
Well, I guess I'm just thinking in terms of that as a practice itself, sort of in addition to being with what is.
Yeah, that wouldn't be a Buddhist practice that I know about. But if you were in the Tibetan Gelugpa tradition, there's probably that kind of practice where you're really, really analyzing your thoughts. But in our Theravada Vipassana world, we don't have a practice like that I know of.
Isn't it also the basis, though, of cognitive restructuring in cognitive therapy?
Yes, very much as cognitive therapy, yes.
So it just seems to me that there's a lot of potential overlap or something that could be integrated into a meditative practice. To me, that I just don't feel a distinction, or it just feels like another potential level of meditative practice.
It's actually a big distinction. Though they can both be meditative practices. In our practice, we do not refute, analyze, logically deconstruct our thoughts. What we do is we dethrone the thoughts by not identifying with them. And then, as you were saying, the thoughts can just pass by. In cognitive therapy, you're very much refuting thoughts and looking for core beliefs under the thoughts and bringing them into consciousness. That's a very different activity than non-conceptual awareness practice, which is what we're doing. So, but you know, check out the Tibetan tradition in the Gelugpa world, where there is a lot more of that kind of cognitive restructuring. Okay. So we'll take a break. So I said this in some of our earlier series, and I think this for me is the most simple little, in a way, summary of everything to do with judging minds. You know, when you wake up to a judgmental thought about yourself, just say to yourself, I know it isn't true, but is it useful? And that is really putting your thoughts in a sane perspective. And as I said in earlier classes, we might find our discriminations useful. It's pretty rare to find a judgmental thought useful. When we discriminate, we focus on whether something is working or not, as opposed to right or wrong or good or bad. We focus on actions and not big generalizations about people. And we are making more perceptions about what's happening right now than some kind of massive generalization over time. For me, those are the three simplest ways to differentiate discriminating thoughts from judging thoughts. So I know it isn't true, but is it useful? So Buddhism starts not with our basic badness. It starts with our basic goodness. Our self-judging thoughts, I like to think of as basically sacrilegious. So if you believe in God, then you could say that we're basically spitting in the face of God when we're really hard on ourselves. If that's not your belief system, you might say you are radically diminishing the miraculousness of 15 billion years of evolution, an unbroken string of chains of events that led to you, and to somehow denigrate that with some puny little thought about yourself is just like, I don't know, sacrilegious to do that to ourselves. The Buddhist view is the opposite, is that we who we are at our core is basic goodness, and we are divine and blessed. And so I want to read a quote from a very famous Tibetan Lama from the 20th century, Lama Yeshe. And he writes, "We hold on to a very limited and limiting view of who we are and what we can become, with the result that our self-image remains oppressively low and negative, and we feel quite inadequate and hopeless. As long as our opinion of ourselves is so miserable, our life will remain meaningless. It is a simple truth that if we identify ourselves as being fundamentally pure, strong, and capable, we will actually develop these qualities. But if we continue to think of ourselves as dull and foolish, that is what we will become." Then he goes on to say, "Deity yoga is one of the most profound ways of lifting our self-image." And that's a Tibetan practice where you actually imagine yourself as an enlightened bodhisattva and visualize yourself as that. And then these qualities are in you already. They just simply get awakened in this kind of archetypal practice. We don't do that practice in our Theravada world. Our sort of fake it till you make it practice is metta, is loving kindness. So rather than visualizing yourself as a deity, you actually get in touch with this basic intention in us to be connected to others. So, so to really benefit the world, to come back to self-love and being motivated, have our self-love be motivated by benefiting the world, we need to really get that we are not these little puny, very painful, very limiting judgments of ourselves. They're bullshit, those thoughts. They're just not true. Our thoughts are never true. And our self-judgmental thoughts are not just not true, they're deeply harmful. So to go to the other side of things, I want to read from Marianne Williamson. She does use the G word, so just a warning. "Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others." We can claim this and not be timid or shy about it. As Trungpa Rinpoche said, timidity is just another ego trip. We can claim our rightful place in this earth, which is we are all, whether you believe in God or not, either science or God, you can still claim yourself as a walking, living miracle. We all are, you know? And Buddhism celebrates this as our Buddha nature. And we can let go. What Buddha nature is, our basic goodness, is how we are when we finally give up our argument with reality and just relax. When we fully relax, what's left behind is our suffering And what's with us is natural ease, natural well-being, natural love. It just is. It's in us. But we're so busy stirring the pot that we don't even know it's who we are already. We're looking for it outside of us. And that's the big joke. It's already us. And we blind ourselves with our seeking. So our metta practice that we're going to do, it can be hard. And we might strain and struggle to force something to happen. It's often hard at first, but it's heading towards who we really are when we're at our best and at ease. So it's a lot of fake it till you make it at first. So I'll just read a little poem about self-love. This is from a Dharma teacher, Vipassana teacher, Robert Hall. It's called, "Within This Body You Are Wearing Now. Inside the bones and the beating in the heart lives one you have been searching for so long. But you must stop moving and embrace. The meeting doesn't happen without your presence, your participation. The same one waiting there is moving in the trees and glistening on the water, growing in the grasses, lurking in the shadows you create. You have nowhere to go. The marriage happened long ago. Behold your mate." So self-love is a beautiful, sacred act that benefits the world. And often when you're in self-love, you get a sense of humor. But sometimes you need the humor just to lighten you up. So I'll just read a few things. Here's some of Woody Allen's kind of pessimistic humor. "Life is full of misery, loneliness, and suffering, and it's all over much too soon. You can live to be 100 if you give up all the things that make you want to live to be 100. If my films make one more person miserable, I'll feel I have done my job. I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve it through not dying." And then you know you're turning the corner towards self-love when you can poke fun at yourself and take yourself a little lightly. So Al Gore, you may have seen him in The Inconvenient Truth when he introduced himself as, "I'm Al Gore. I used to be the next president of the United States." Abraham Lincoln was accused of being two-faced, and he replied, "If I were two-faced, would I be wearing this one?" He was not known for being the most handsome of men. And even Ronald Reagan, during the '84 campaign against Walter Mondale, Reagan diffused the age issue, quipping, "I won't make age an issue of this campaign. I'm not going to exploit for political purposes my opponent's youth and inexperience." So. So we have now about 25 minutes, and I'm going to guide us in some practices. I'll do one short one with us, and then we'll have a little bit of interaction, and then we'll do another one. So if you would, just take your meditation seat. This will be short. So remember, I was talking about being friendly to our experience and then being friendly just sort of more generally to loving ourselves. So this is really about just being friendly towards your experience. And I've done this with you before. So if you've done it already, you haven't done this one. The way it is right now is different than before. So even though the practice is the same, this is a very simple practice of exercising the heart muscle of grandmotherly or grandfatherly acceptance. Grandma or grandpa with their young child, young grand, child who's sort of like going through some sort of conniption, and the grandparent just being, of course, or of course, dear. So just try this and see what happens. The practice is simply to notice whatever's happening, and for every time you notice something, you just say, of course, silently to it. So you notice the children playing, of course. You feel throb in the knee, of course. You notice an image of a car, of course. You notice the breath, of course. You notice, what is this silly exercise? Of course. Just say of course to everything and see how it goes. How was it?
It was easier to not hang on so hard.
Easier. Easier to let go. Some nods.
I thought it was friendlier.
Friendlier.
Almost, you know, almost soothing. Right up there. Take it light. Take whatever was going on more lightly. Laugh at it a little bit.
See, you may have noticed that everything you said, of course, too, had already happened. So to not say of course is arguing with reality. Jack has already popped out of the box, and then you say of course. That makes sense. But if you say, what's Jack doing out of the box, right? That's just like, it's already happened. So when we get really conscious, of course is the only logical response. And you may decide to take action because, of course, the next moment might be, this is not okay. And you say, of course, to that. It's time to take action, of course. But actually, this is a profound way of dropping the argument against reality. Everything you become aware of has already happened. To fight it is like trying to deny the past. It's already happened. So we can wake up to it and respond, but that's very different from arguing against it as if it shouldn't have happened. It's already happened. So this practice of course is very, very helpful if you're in some kind of knot. Whether it's a decision about doing something or some kind of conflict with your partner or, conflict with a coworker, whatever, or someone cuts you off in traffic, just say of course to everything. You need to stop and be aware of what's happening and then just say of course. And on a long retreat, I had basically cornered myself in some little tiny inescapable area of misery that I couldn't get out of. So finally I just started saying, of course, you know. Who do you think you are to be here on retreat? Of course. Oh, noticing doubt, of course. You know, just on and on and on. And it really brought in some space and some air and some okayness. And usually when that happens, there's actually been some clarity around that you just didn't notice. You're so busy in reaction. But when we get out of our reaction, often it becomes a lot more clear what to do. So, yes?
It felt to me like that perspective almost siphoned out. I mean, in terms of the thought stream, the things that were coming up were sort of thoughts that don't often enjoy that type of acceptance, basically. So it was like, get it while the getting is good.
There you go. We learn a lot when we accept our experience and don't fuss with it. Okay, we don't have a lot of time, but now I'm going to guide us in a practice of metta and a practice of directing this loving kindness towards ourselves. So let's just start by get in touch with, in yourself, this basic urge for well-being. Getting it, that everything we do, even when we're confused and deluded and causing misery for ourselves or others, it's still in some way a basic drive for well-being. And the Dalai Lama says that this urge for well-being is our birthright. And it's the birthright of any sentient being. It's noble and sacred, this urge for well-being. It's actually what leads to awakening. This is a very wholesome urge. So just feel it in you. feel this basic goodness that in you that wants to be free from suffering, wants to be happy, wants to be loving and loved, wants to connect. And if you would, bring to mind some simple little thing you like about yourself. No yes buts. I kind of like this, but yeah, there's all these other things I don't like. Just if for this meditation, it'll help you to have one simple remembrance of something you like about yourself. It doesn't matter what, anything at all. And then in this practice, what we do is we repeat some phrases. And it often works best to hold these phrases in our heart. I'm going to suggest some very simple phrases and see if they resonate with you. May I be safe and protected. May I be healthy and strong. May I love myself exactly as I am. May I be truly happy. I'll just repeat them a few times. May I be safe and protected. May I be healthy and strong. May I love myself exactly as I am. May I be truly happy. May I be safe and protected. May I be healthy and strong. May I love myself just as I am. May I be truly happy. So the idea in this practice is to use simple phrases like this. And because we don't have a lot of time, I would just recommend using these basic phrases. You can make some of your own up later. See what happens if you just keep repeating these phrases. Your meditation object is the meaning of the phrase. And hold it lightly. Don't try to squeeze friendliness into your heart. Can't be done. Friendliness is a quality of relaxation and ease. So just hold the phrases lightly, focusing your awareness on the meaning of the phrase. Repeat them often enough so you have a good object to be aware of, but not so often that it feels mechanical. I'll repeat them one last time. May I be safe and protected. May I be healthy and strong. May I love myself exactly as I am. May I be truly happy. If you're going off into stories, thoughts, you can just note it as thinking and come back to your phrases. You're meditating on these phrases just as if you were being with the breath, light, relaxed, alert, not forcing, just being with the phrase. if you're going to have any thought at all apart from the phrases, let it be this appreciation of yourself, something you like about yourself. So just have that thought every now and then. It'll help the practice. And you might find this helpful. Invite someone into your practice who can just kind of sit down with you. A person that might help you feel friendliness towards yourself. So some kind of benefactor or mentor or teacher or even parent or relative or dear friend or partner, but someone that really holds us in love and care. Let them be with you, next to you, in front of you, wherever you want them. Let them kind of sort of guide the atmosphere, whisper the atmosphere of friendliness. They would, this is someone who might have these exact same wishes for you. So just let them help you kind of hold this atmosphere of friendliness and see what happens if you keep repeating the phrases as you let them be with you. May all beings everywhere, any being at all that yearns for some kind of well-being or thriving, may all beings be safe and protected, healthy and strong. May all beings love themselves just as they are. May we all be truly happy. So pretty much right at 8:30, so I wish you all well, and may this be a week of self-love. And I would suggest one practice, if you wanted to do this with someone in your life, is form a little mutual self-admiration society and spend 10 minutes telling each other what you like about yourself. It can be a fun thing to do with a partner or a friend. My wish for myself is that I get this talk online okay, unlike last time. But if anyone has not been to my website, it's called truehomewithin.net. If you're on the email list, I'll email you the link. And I did put a description generally of loving-kindness practice in the essay section of that website, so you can refer to that as well. And hopefully the talk will get there as well, though you've already heard it, but maybe it won't apply. But anyway, have a good week. Blessings. Mm-hmm.